Today we will continue with the renal mesization group that I started yesterday. So let's briefly review what I did yesterday. Yesterday we went back into mean field theory. And then I pointed out that so-called Landau's theory of phase transition abstracts some simple features from mean field theory and then drops many inessential details as far as phases are concerned. And it focuses on possibility of second order phase transition, first order phase transition, when the two meet, so-called tri-critical point and other things. And it's exactly like van der Waals equation of state, which was very helpful in classical theory of liquid and gas. So when you talk about be it magnetism or superconductivity or ferroelectricity, where there is a phase change, Landau's theory works remarkably well. And also, Landau's theory incorporates fundamental symmetries in the problem. Like even in the simple case of magnets, we saw that the free energy, Landau's free energy, is an even function of magnetization, meaning that you can have magnetization up or down. When you go to more complicated cases, the parameter, so-called order parameter, which signifies the order, could be a vector or it could be a tensor, and it could be more complicated. Then Landau's prescription is that construct symmetric invariants out of those combinations, like simple scalar product, in the case that I case a vector, and then write down a free energy, which is a very simple analytic function of the deviation from critical temperature and the order parameter. And from that, you can go a long way. This is what Landau said. Then I pointed out that thinking physically, you can elevate Landau's free energy into some effective action or effective free energy density, and even start discussing fluctuations in the ordered state that Landau talks about. So the generalization was very simple. I said that if I consider this Ising model. So to twist or to change the magnetization costs some energy, A. And then the rest of the terms remains the same. Now I have a spatial integral. So you give me a configuration of magnetization, which is a function of R now. I will evaluate this and give you what is the free energy. Then people doing statistical mechanics started saying that this could be used as Hamiltonian, as we did in the case of classical statistical mechanics. And you can formally integrate over all configurations and get information about free energy and various singularities. So this is Landau's theory of phase transition in a nutshell. And so already here, there is a lot of universalities hiding behind, because I have some unknown parameter Tc. I may not worry about the value of Tc when I discuss existence of first order, second order phase transition, tri-critical point. And there may be dependence on material properties through this stiffness constant A plus some lambda, which is some other parameter. Otherwise, it's fairly universal. And if I solve this problem formally exactly, I will get critical behavior, as we saw in the case of mean field theory and other theories. So the task before us, when we do normalization group theory and so on, is to extract this critical exponent, that is the nature of the singularities. So it's a very well-defined task. So here you have a system which is going to describe some critical state where correlation functions diverge, there are hierarchy of organization of fluctuations. So we are interested in few critical exponents. Already I knew and eta. We talked about this. That is, this talks about specific heat divergence. This talks about how magnetization vanishes. This talks about how susceptibility diverges as you approach TC. This says that if you sit at TC, then apply a magnetic field, what is the singular response of the magnetization? And then nu tells about how correlation length diverges. And then eta talks about what I called as anomalous dimension. Please recall that this is about behavior of two-spin correlation function. So the entire search in the renormalization group game is to get these quantities called critical exponents. For mean field theory, already we saw they have very simple values. For example, alpha equal to 0, and then beta is 1/2, and so on. I have written it down. Now, there are corrections to it, and it turns out these quantities have a very specific value depending on the family they belong to. For example, if I look at liquid gas transition in 3 dimension, or if you look at a ferromagnetic transition in 3 dimension described by an Ising model, all these numbers are identical. So that is a universality, or if you take a ferroelectric. However, if you take a magnet in which the order parameter is a vector, like an isotropic ferromagnet in which the magnetic moment can point in any direction, so any direction is equally preferable. So the free energy has a SU2 invariance with respect to rotation of this magnetization vector. In that case, you have a different set of critical exponents. So that's called a Heisenberg universality class. So there are many systems which belong to that. Then it turns out there are situations where you have M, which is just 2-component. You can imagine a situation in which spins are forced to lie in a plane. So spins can point in any direction in the plane, but they cannot stand up or stand down. So this will be called the XY model. And it turns out nature of fluctuation here as well as here are very different. For example, if we take this so-called XY model, it shows a very strong dependence on dimensionality. Here I did not explicitly say, but in the next few lectures I will keep mentioning that when you talk about Ising order parameter, these exponents do depend on dimension, because already we saw explicitly that in 1 dimension, when we solve the Ising model exactly, there is no phase transition, and this they have some value. And Ansager's solutions give you some other value. In 3 dimension, when you do things numerically and approximately, you get some value. And in 4 dimension and above, you get value which coincides with mean field theory. So these so-called universal quantities do depend on dimension, d. And then do depend on n. Let's call n as the number of components of the vector. So in the case of Heisenberg model, n equal to 3. For Ising, it's n equal to 1. For XY, n equal to 2. So they depend on dimensionality and number of components of the order parameter. Yes. I pointed it yesterday. It is so you have basically take derivative of M and then dot it with and then sum over all the 3 components. That's the first term. Then the rest of the terms will be m dot m whole square. And in fact, very often, you will specialize the magnitude of m to be 1. You say that, then you know these terms will not come. You say that my magnetization vector is fixed. It is not going to vanish even at the critical point. The disorder will come because the spins point randomly in many, many directions. So then this will become a problem involving theta and phi. So I'll have a field which has defines about in the, you know, if you think about spherical polar coordinate, I have an M vector which is pointing in some direction whose magnitude is 1. So in an arbitrary point can be denoted by theta. theta phi. So I have a field theory in terms of theta and phi. In fact, that's the way information about theta phi comes. For example, in the case of XY model, if I want to do it on a lattice, it is a very friendly form. It says, it's a digression, but it's important. I have a spin, and I have another spin in the neighboring. So the interaction between the two is going to depend on the dot product. And if the magnitude of the spin is fixed, this dot product is essentially theta I minus theta j. So this will be so-called XY model. It's where this is theta ij, angle between two spins. And it turns out this problem is also very interesting, and it has a very interesting physics. Nobody has solved it exactly. In one dimension, you can essentially solve it exactly using tricks similar to what we did before. You'll get it in terms of Bessel functions and so on. The transfer matrix that you want to calculate there corresponds to an integral equation where the eigenfunctions are Bessel functions and some eigenvalues are there. Then when you step up and go to two dimension, something remarkable happens. Unlike Ising model, there is no unique phase transition at a critical point. In the 2D XY model, you will have a phase transition starting at a critical point, and the system will remain critical all along the line up to zero temperature. In fact, this is famous Kosterlitz-Thouless transition. If I have time, I will spend about 20 minutes towards the end, because it's a very important problem in condensed matter physics, which gave completely new insights into quantum field theory. And many of the developments that came 20, 30 years ago were inspired by this fundamental work of Kosterlitz-Thouless and Brzezinski about topological singularities, namely vertices in these field configurations, which play a fundamental role. I'm just saying it in words, but it can be done. Now, when you go to three dimension, XY model behaves like an Ising model in the sense there is nothing very spectacular except the critical exponents are different. Okay. So this is the kind of problem that we will address when we do renormalization group theory. We'll imagine some order in which there is going to be a vector or a scalar and look at universal behavior critical exponents. So most of the experimentally observed things can be classified according to universality classes just based on these few numbers like dimensionality and number of components of the order parameter. There is one more thing which is true in some cases. I assume that the spins have short-range interaction. That is, if I take two spins, there is a coupling between them expressed by J times S1 times S2. But if I separate the spins, in practical situations, the interaction exponentially decays. So we replace it, approximated by nearest neighbor interaction. But there are systems like ferroelectrics, where what undergoes ordering are dipole moments. And ferroelectrics are insulators. So this dipole interaction is not screened. So you have a dipole-dipole interaction, which minimizes energy depending on where the two dipoles are and what is the relative angle between the dipole moments. So more importantly, this interaction has a power law behavior. It goes as 1 over r cube, but at long distances. So then they belong to different universality class. So depending on dimensionality, number of components of the order parameter, when you consider vector order parameter, and then range of interaction, which in general can be parameterized. You say that the interaction between two spins, suppose you take Ising model, there are situations in which you can replace it by some A naught. For example, A naught greater than 2 is, for practical purposes, short range interaction. Sometimes it may be very slowly varying function. A naught less than 2, then it becomes more complicated. So all those things have been analyzed using this renormalization group approach. So the whole purpose of this exercise or this study is to isolate singularities and understand them. Just understand singularities in free energy function. That turns out to be a very beautiful task, very challenging task, and at the same time, It led connection to conformal field theory and many, many fascinating things. So while I insist, you know, I'm talking about like many people, including field theory, we are interested in long distance behavior and infrared behavior. Condensed matter physics, you know, challenges you very often, saying that you should worry about microscopic details. In fact, this statement that I'm making is related to statistical mechanics of so-called frustrated spin system, so-called spin glasses. So I have to make some statement about it because even it's easy to understand why microscopic details brings you very new universality classes and completely new physics. So this is something I will touch, and then because I will not come back to it later, so then we will go to RG. It's a very interesting thing. We kept talking about square lattice Ising model. And ferromagnetic interaction between spins. Then it turns out, if you look at magnetic materials that nature gives you, most often the interaction is antiferromagnetic due to something physics called super exchange interaction in insulators. Most often, two spins would like to be antiparallel. So the interaction Hamiltonian is not minus, it is in fact, it is positive. You can put it modulus here. Okay, then we will say, what is the connection of this statistical mechanics of this problem to this problem? You will immediately see it's very simple. In fact, you can transform this problem into this problem. How do I do that? So I say that, okay, I take this, in other words, if I minimize the energy of this Hamiltonian, I get all spins up or all spins down as a ground state configuration. If I minimize this, I will get spins in one sublattice. This is called a sublattice A, alternate spins, for example, which I denote by a double circle. So spins are down. And in the other sublattice B, spins are down. Now, for this particular problem, whether I solve statistical mechanics of this or whether I solve statistical mechanics of this, it doesn't matter. They are identical. It can be explicitly shown by showing the following mathematical transformation. That is, take Si and then replace it by minus Si. Because anyway, when I do statistical summation, I sum over all configurations. So if I do a change of that integration sign, physics should not change. The mathematical expression remains identical. So when you do this, and in particular, you do this for sites belonging to sublattice A or sublattice B, then you notice here the coupling is that the spin at sublattice A is connected to spins at sublattice B. So when you do this transformation, I will get a minus sign, which will be swallowed by this, and I get back this. So in other words, you give me an antiferromagnetic configuration. There is a corresponding ferromagnetic configuration with identical energy. So I can do this simple translation. And whatever I know about ferromagnet, I know about antiferromagnet. But that is not true about magnetic field. Because when you do a transformation of the magnetic field, spins belonging to sublattice A will see positive field, sublattice B will see negative field because I have changed the sign. So as long as there is no uniform magnetic field, these two problems are identical. So you can make a transformation from here to here and get everything right. But the situation completely falls flat when I change one microscopic detail. Namely, I don't consider a square lattice, but a triangular lattice. Unfortunately, nature often gives us triangular lattice. That is, a lattice in which a site has six neighbors. And then I have, yes.
I'm sorry, you may have already talked about this, but when you look at the Ising model in the right term, the lambda of the function, why will you get a delta m term that you wrote when you carried over
to the thing? Here. Oh, I put it by hand. So what I said was, when Landau did mean field theory, he ignored spatial fluctuations. He looked at some state in which things are uniform. He did not look at it short distance scales and at short time scale. So now, when I approach critical phenomena, it's very clear that focusing on a collective variable alone is not sufficient. There are fluctuations that are happening even in mean field theory, and they are hierarchically organized at all length scale. So I should worry about spatial variation of so-called order parameter, which is manifest if I look at the microscopic Hamiltonian. Because in a microscopic Hamiltonian, I don't have M. I have microscopic spin variables which are fluctuating. And they tend to group together and behave like magnetization. So a way to connect to microscopic theory is by putting by hand the simplest term which takes spatial variation into account. It says if there is a small gradient, you spend energy which is square of that. So this is where this origin of this term. Does it answer the question? Okay. Okay. So this is a digression, but very important, because this will take us to a very important field called frustrated statistical mechanical system, spin glasses and glasses, which is unfortunately, there is no time for me to go into it. But whatever I have said is straightforward, you understand it. Now I give you another problem, which is so-called problem of same Ising model, but on a triangular lattice. So this is called the triangle. In triangular lattice, you can very easily see, like in a square lattice, you had two sublattices, you have three sublattices, three equivalent sublattices. You can call it as a sublattice A, sublattice B, and sublattice. And each sublattice is a triangular lattice. For example, this will become A, this will become A, and this will become B, and so on. Sorry? Okay, I'm sure I have made some mistake. A and A, B and B. This is C. Yeah, so for example, this forms a sublattice. Right? If I connect B's, that forms another sublattice. Okay, that's a basic thing. So now I have a problem. I want you to find the ground state of a ferromagnet. It's very simple. All spins are up. But once you have an antiferromagnet, you have a problem which was, the name was called, so P.W. Anderson called that as frustration. So he said, once you have such a situation, the name of the game is frustration, because let's consider three spins. So they have antiferromagnetic coupling. So I say that this spin is up, this spin is down, then I have a problem. This neighbor wants to be anti-parallel to this spin, but that makes this bonding unhappy. Similarly, I can maybe put this up, and then this makes this unhappy. So at best, I can satisfy two neighbors in this three-side case. One neighbor is always unhappy. So you notice that unlike the happy situation before, where you had, if you consider four spins like this spin, you have either this state or all spin flip state. Only two ground states are there. Now you notice there are more number of ground states. So you're not able to satisfy every interaction. So this is called frustration. And remarkably, what it leads to is, this leads to complete suppression of finite temperature phase transition in a triangular lattice antiferromagnet. So, as I said, in the case of ferromagnet, you have phase transition at identical temperature due to the symmetry that it pointed out. This symmetry is absent in the case of triangular lattice. It pushes the problem into a different universality class in which there is a phase transition only at zero temperature. Also, this problem raises several interesting issues about Ehrenfest theorem and so on. Briefly, I'll lead to it and then go to our original aim. Sorry. Now, please. Okay. So far I have been talking about triangular lattice in two dimensions. So here, in this lattice with nearest neighbor interaction, there is maximal frustration. and it does not show phase transition. Now I go to next dimension. Then in next dimension, like three dimension, a simple cubic lattice is not frustrated. Whereas similarly, a body-centered cubic lattice is not frustrated. But if you go along that line, you find face-centered cubic is frustrated. But then, okay, in fact, the answer will come after I discuss this. So let me take the antiferromagnet in the case of triangular lattice and think about what is the nature of the ground state. If there is a frustration, is it possible for me to form a translation invariant ground state in which the energy is minimized? Maybe there are a few more ground states. Very soon you will find that you cannot do that. What you find is you have exponentially large number of ground states. Let me give you one such state. So in a triangular lattice, you have spins surrounded by six spins, and then this continues. Now, for example, I can take this cluster and put this spin up, this spin down, this spin up, this spin down. Now, if I look at the central spin, it sees zero mean field because half the neighbors are pointing up, half the neighbors are pointing down. So if I write down the energy for this cluster, the energy is indifferent whether the spin is up or down. So in this simple cluster, I have shown you a state in which the ground state is doubly degenerate. Now I can imagine identical cluster. In other words, what I do is, in this ground state, I take two sublattices A and B, and make them an antiferromagnet. Because if you put sublattice A and B together, it's a hexagonal lattice. I'm sorry, I should have mentioned it. This is simple, but let me illustrate. Suppose you take hexagonal lattice. You all know that this is in the context of graphene and honeycomb and so on. Now, if I want to construct a simple triangular lattice, what do? I put a site at the center. Then this becomes a triangular lattice. So this is sublattice A, this is sublattice B, this is sublattice C. So what I have done here is, I have satisfied spins living in sublattice A and B. And then it turns out, no, if you look at C, C lives in a happy world where it can be indifferent. It can point up or it can point down. Now if you ask the question, what is the degeneracy of the ground state? If n is the number of spins in the problem, it is 2 to the power of n over 3. Now in thermodynamics and in statistical mechanics, there is a third law of thermodynamics which says that the ground state entropy should vanish. In this problem, this is the number of configurations of the ground state. So if you take log of this and divide it by n, you have a finite number, 1/3 log. So it's non-vanishing, so it works against Nernst theorem. But that's okay because this is not a physical system, it's a model system. In reality, quantum effects and so on will come in and lift this degeneracy. So what is important is to point out that the very ground state I start to do statistical mechanics, this problem is very unstable. There are many, many ground states, exponentially large number of ground states. Yes. Sorry?
Does it mean that thermodynamics gives you a reason to vary classical systems for quantum mechanics?
Oh, you can say that, yeah. In fact, a famous example is so-called ice rule. It turns out, this was in fact pointed out by Linus Pauling many years ago. If you look at the structure of ice, every oxygen atom has two protons, two hydrogen atoms. And in the structure, it turns out you can, in a hydrogen bond, you can put the proton in two places. Here I have an oxygen, here I have another oxygen. So the proton can be here, or the proton can be here. And of course, correspondingly, I have to move the protons around. In other words, if you give me a classical state of ice in a crystalline state, you will find consistent with so-called Pauling's rule, you can put protons in exponentially large number of ways. So ice will be a very good example where Ehrenfest theorem is violated. But then you say that, well, it is true in the absence of quantum mechanics. In the presence of quantum mechanics, the proton can, quantum mechanically, tunnel back and forth, and this much degeneracy will be lifted. So that quantum mechanics is not contained in this model. I have ignored quantum mechanics. So that's why I get, now this is not the only ground state. You can see many, many other patterns where you have free spins essentially running around, sitting there and giving you a large interrupt. So there's a very beautiful paper by Vanier with an appendix by P.W. Anderson. He's not a co-author, but so he basically addresses the problem of Ising model on a triangular lattice in two dimensions. And he shows, following Ansager's type of method, he computes free energy analytically and shows that the transition temperature is pushed down to zero temperature because you have fluctuations even in the ground state. So once you hit the system, any order that you started with will undergo thermal melting. But now you can ask the question, so here is a very interesting situation where microscopic details matters. So this something we repeatedly seen in condensed matter physics. On the one hand, we look for universal features and field theory where we forget about microscopic details, but you cannot always forget. For example, you can take a ferromagnet on a hexagonal lattice, doesn't matter because a hexagonal lattice has two sublattices. So you can do the same transformation I did for square lattice, and statistical mechanics will be similar. But once I go to triangular lattice, things become complicated. Yes. Oh, okay, very good. That's a separate class, but since you asked that question, so suppose I look at this, then essentially the potential well seen by proton has this form. So in classical mechanics, you say that the mass is so heavy, the particle can be here or here, it cannot quantum mechanically tunnel. Now in quantum mechanics, we know that they can undergo tunneling, and the ground state will have a wave function like this, in which the wave function is nodeless, and there is an excited state in which the wave function will look like this. So it will have amplitude on both wells, but the phase of the wave function will change. So I'm plotting psi as a function of x. Now this is called bonding state, this is called anti-bonding state. Now if you calculate the energy, there will be a very small splitting, bonding state and anti-bonding state. This splitting is governed by quantum mechanical tunneling. You can do WKB approximation and calculate the tunneling matrix element. So here is a situation in which this degeneracy is lifted by quantum mechanics. Now you have... Okay, that will take us beyond what I wanted. I can discuss this. So the question is, how is it connected to glasses, spin glasses, and so on? And that's a separate thing. I will not discuss it here. Maybe we can discuss after the talk. So it's very important that there are model classical statistical mechanics problem where you are hit by enormous degeneracy and no order at any finite temperature. And in fact, we can construct similar models in higher dimensions also. Okay. Now let us, so that was a digression. What was I trying to do? I see a lot of reflection. Okay, so yeah, we talked about universality and we said you can forget about details, but there are situations in which you cannot forget about details. This is one good example. Okay. Now let me go back to what I wanted to do next. So the next thing is to do these things systematically. That is, basically, we are searching for singularity and try to understand nature of the singularity. We may not even worry about the location of the critical point. As long as it's a finite temperature, it's OK. I want to see behavior close to that. So there, I pointed out, essentially, even in mean field theory, if you look at the free energy evaluated at equilibrium, let's say at the function of temperature, and magnetic field, the only two parameters. So this is the free energy expression, which is m square t minus tc plus some lambda by 4 m to the power of 4 minus hm. Now I can minimize the free energy with respect to m and then get relation between magnetization, temperature, and magnetic field and put it back, and then I will get some expression for free energy. It's a simple thing to do. I don't know if I have, maybe I will. Yeah, this is, you will see that even in mean field theory, the free energy that you evaluate as a function of temperature is non-analytic. It's a very simple thing, but it's good to see. Because we are looking for non-analytic pieces in free energy, it's good to understand it in detail in this simple case. So let me take the case of first magnetic field equal to 0, and then the minimization gives me m t minus tc below tc is equal to lambda m cube. So m cancels, I have m square, so I get the simple result that m goes as t minus tc. Since I'm below tc, this is negative, and so on. This is the beginning. So this is just graphically, you say magnetization vanishes at tc, a square root of t, square root of t minus tc. Now I put it back, put back this, and then I can ask question, what is the magnetization above tc? It is 0. So if I put this value in the expression for free energy is 0 above tc within mean field theory. There is always a constant term which we have subtracted, so we will not worry about it. So you get a very interesting and simple result. Free energy, equilibrium free energy as a function of t is 0 above tc. And then below tc, so I substitute here, and then I get t minus tc whole square. That is equilibrium free energy as a function of t is t minus tc square below tc. So I get some behavior like this. So there is a clearly a singularity, that is, I have a parabola before below tc, I have some function which vanishes identically. So if I take derivative of this function, the slopes do not match, I have divergence and so on. So you see a very simple mean field theory already gives you a singularity. The singularity is not divergence, it's a soft singularity because the slope changes or higher derivatives changes as you go across tc. You can discuss similar thing as a function of magnetic field. You can solve this equation in general with m and h and exhibit it. So, but let me exhibit the singularity of free energy as a function of magnetic field. So I sit at t equal to tc, in which case this term will disappear. So my free energy is lambda by 4 m to the power of 4 minus hm. So now I find the equilibrium value df by dm equals lambda m cube minus h. So m cube is a h. Goes as h to the power of, m goes as h to the power of 1/3. Now I can substitute back. And then when you do it, graphically this is what happens. That is at t equal to tc, the free energy that I have evaluated as a function of magnetic field has this behavior. It is linear and it has a slope which is like this. So this is a singularity. Because as I cross zero magnetic field and go from positive to negative field, the slope changes its sign. Now, if I am away from TC, you can, it's very easy to do this. What you find is the free energy as a function of magnetic field has a quadratic behavior, so no singularity. So even in this very simple case of two variables, transition temperature and so they are the critical variables. I'll have to take them together to the TC, which is TC comma 0. I have singular behavior of free energy as a function of magnetic field, or singular behavior of free energy as a function of temperature. Now we are going to look for more complicated singularities. Singularities say logarithmic singularity. In fact, in two-dimensional Ising model, what Ansager found was that the free energy as a function of T is even softer in some sense. It's log of T minus TC and times TC, T minus TC, and so on. Okay. So now this is what made people just before Kadanoff to think about so-called homogeneity hypothesis or scaling hypothesis, which is what I will do next. And then we will go into formalizing it using renormalization group theory. Because all these things suggest power law behavior of singular part of the free energy. So now this exercise tells you, I have not shown it explicitly, that free energy as a function of temperature and magnetic field has some regular piece. And there is a small piece which controls nature of phase transition. It's a singular piece, and we are focusing on that singular piece. And mean field theory explicitly contains only the singular piece, and it has this behavior. So it is here, Weidem and others hypothesized, saying that as you approach the critical point, there seems to be something universal, in the sense there is one scale which is governing all the physics. That scale is basically correlation length. So in the sense, as you approach the critical point, I have correlated domains of spin. Suppose I approach the magnet from above TC. So I find many, many spins which hold hands together and point one direction. Then they dissolve. And if I look at this spin configuration and do some averaging, I find some characteristic length scale below which spins tends to be correlated. So it is that correlation length, which is we call zeta, which is going to control the physics. So that means I should be able to scale my physical quantities, at least a singular part, in terms of this variable, and see some universal features. This was the idea of Weidem. So essentially, at scales above the critical length scale, the domains that I'm thinking about, the correlated spins, are essentially free. Now, as I approach TC, this becomes larger and larger. And I go to temperature very large compared to TC, the correlation length is essentially lattice parameter. So if I look at this spin, and it's essentially uncorrelated from its third neighbor. So this is a key parameter, namely correlation length, which we have to focus and then discuss the physics. And this happens in a very natural way by construction when you do RG, and then some of the hypothesis of Weidem and so on naturally comes about. And then RG also gives you a way of calculating critical exponents. So now let me look at the so-called scaling hypothesis of Weidem. It basically says that if you calculate the singular part of the free energy, I keep changing. In this case, T is, a dimensionless parameter which tells you how far away I am from TC. And H is a dimensionless parameter. H equal to 0 is a critical point. So that this function exhibits singularity. And it's going to be governed by some single scale, forced Weidem to make the following hypothesis that, like, you know, here, suppose I know that there is a function which is behaving like lambda to the power of a. Then I can make the hypothesis that I can say that I'll come to this. Okay, so Weidem essentially made the hypothesis that if I take this f and scale t in a particular way, let me call it as lambda t, and then h in a particular way, let me call h, I should get back lambda. In other words, I can bring this on the left-hand side and saying that if I scale this relevant argument, not by lambda, but lambda to the power of some number, which I do not know what it is. Similarly, lambda to the power of some number corresponding to this variable. So this is called Vadim scaling hypothesis. Now it turns out this hypothesis, what it does is it says my singular behavior of free energy is controlled by just two parameters. This T and lambda to the power of h. So I should call it as some, that's a convention, some number which depends on term, which has an index t and which has an index h. So all critical phenomena in this language is related to just two parameters. And we saw before that critical phenomena has about 6 critical exponents. So this says that there should be relation among themselves. In fact, if you just follow Vadim's scaling hypothesis and calculate from here, because this is a definition of free energy, it has this behavior. Now I can take this definition and take derivative with respect to temperature, for example, at zero field, and then extract the exponent alpha. And I can take temperature with respect to h at zero temperature and get the so-called exponent 1 over delta, because specific heat is related to t to the power of minus alpha. Susceptibility, magnetization at Tc is related to, and so on. So when you do that, for example, I will not do this. It's a straightforward calculation. Yes? Exactly. Yeah. Okay. So in the lambda, in the land of free energy description, that you know, land, in the mean field theory, if we keep track of all the terms, you see that there is a constant term. Well, I got the integration and so on, which I ignored, because that is smoothly varying across Tc. So just by construction, I'm explicitly taking the singular part alone. So even within a mean field theory and in the model I discussed, namely a system with longer range interaction, there is a constant piece. So this separation comes out in a very natural way. So I have some function which depends on T and H. So there is a regular part, and I mean, it's explicitly in this. And when you do Ansager solution, that's what you see. In Ansager solutions, you will find that free energy as a function of T minus Tc, it will become times log of. That's why when you take derivative with respect to temperature, you get log divergence. So this is something you can mathematically show by taking Ansager solution and doing it. In fact, you can also show it mathematically for 1D icing model, which we know how to solve it exactly. So if you do an expansion around T equal to 0, where which is a Tc, you will find a non-analytic piece in 1D icing model also. Please do it. That's, you know, it will tell you, answer the question, how in a very natural way the full free energy gets decomposed into two pieces, a regular and singular piece. Okay. So here the hypothesis of Vadim is that from mean field theory, it tells me that I have two relevant terms, two important terms, which controls phase transition. So as I scale that temperature, it should essentially give me this form. That is, by putting appropriate B and T, I should be able to extract this lambda outside. This is a hypothesis. Vadim said that if this hypothesis is true, immediately many, many scaling laws follow. I will just write them what they are. And in fact, we will see that there are 4 scaling laws. One is a famous Rushbrook. So the first thing is, if I put h equal to 0 and take derivative with respect to t, I find that this exponent, the magnetization exponent beta, I'm sorry, I have been using different notations, so I'll call it as a P and Q. So beta turns out to be 1 minus q by p. It simply follows from the definition of the beta exponent, namely behavior of magnetization as you approach TC, how it vanishes. Similarly, the alpha exponent can be shown to be equal to and so on. Now, if you just, since there are two independent parameters, you have many exponents, finally you will find that there are relations like this, alpha plus 2 beta plus gamma equal to 2. This is called a Rushbrook equality. Then there is an equality found by Vadim, which is gamma equal to beta into delta minus 1. And then there is inequality due to Fisher. Gamma is equal to nu times 2 minus eta. And then there is an equality due to Josephson, which is nu times d . So these two should follow by an analysis of free energy expression, because this does not contain the nu exponent, which is related to divergence of correlation length. That is, correlation length diverges as 1 over t minus tc by to the power of nu. Similarly, eta also tells about the anomalous dimension, which also appears in correlation function. And in this correlation function, it doesn't appear. So you can derive these two very easily from this. And Josephson inequality contains some information about spatial dimensionality. So for that, you will have to again use correlation functions and some locality and get that. So I will not go into the details, but just want to point out that the exponents that we are searching for are the singularities are not too many. They are all governed by these simple constraints. So essentially, for Ising model problem, you will have to get these two quantities close to the critical point. So these two are universal number. And it turns out for Ansager Ising model, because it's a logarithmic singularity, one of these exponents is simply 1. So Ansager struggled hard to get a number 1 as a result. When you go to other problems, it would be different from 1. OK? So this is about scaling hypothesis. Now the next thing we will do is we will try to rationalize this hypothesis using Karnov's block spin argument. Because here, there was no proving. That's why it's a hypothesis. It says that as you reach the critical point, the singular part of the free energy is singular, and it can be characterized by two exponents, and you can extract them. So this is also called a homogeneity hypothesis. Homogeneity in the sense of mathematics. So it's a homogeneous variable. And in the sense, you can scale it. And then what you will get out will be lambda. OK. Now the next thing I will do is go to renormalization group and effectively get this behavior that was hypothesized by Vadim. And in the process, we will get many insights about the problem. So because we are looking for these two exponents, which will reveal itself as you approach the critical point, the process of renormalization group is a kind of taking the problem and then pruning it and looking at what is happening. It's not solving for the full partition function. That's a big load, which Ansager could carry and solve for the full partition function and extract the singular part of the free energy. Here, from the beginning, in the RJ procedure, you can get the regular part also. But most of the interest is isolating out the singular part. And it's remarkable that in simple model systems, you can do this just by some few steps. So-called, that's what we saw in one dimension. So now, to motivate Karnov's, I will motivate Karnov block spin hypothesis, and then do it in detail for one dimension. And then we go to two dimension, and then look at consequences. And before I forget, I will just, it's not relevant for the course. It's totally different. but you will enjoy learning about it. I heard a talk 2 days ago by Juan. Forget his second family name. He's a condensed matter postdoc. He gave a very nice talk about teaching a computer to recognize whether a given spin pattern is critical or not critical. It's a very good question, right? Because he does Monte Carlo simulation and generate configurations at various temperature. So in principle, I can take that and do spin-spin correlation measurement and do it in detail. But is it possible to teach the computer to recognize a pattern? Like, you know, we know the field of computer recognition has evolved enormously, and it can recognize patterns, and it can recognize grammar mistakes in sentences, and so on. And behind this, there is something called Boltzmann. Again, thermodynamics comes in here. Boltzmann learning algorithm. So basically, this is also called neural network algorithm. But the point I'm going to say is that there is a Juan referred to me a very nice paper by these two gentlemen. Apparently, one of them will be giving a talk the first week of November here. Pankaj Mehta and David Schwab. Okay. The title of the paper is, this is why I'm saying, an exact mapping between variational renormalization group and what is called deep learning. So after reading this title, I am trying to begin. So what we are doing in RG is we try to learn about the system as far as a singular part is concerned. So as we do RG and then go deeper and deeper, we learn about the critical exponents. And here the people, people doing optimization and Google and many other people, they are interested in something else, pattern recognition, in a very efficient way. And these two guys have found that the algorithm people have developed completely independently in the field of pattern recognition say that there is a variational renormalization group at the background discovered by Kadanoff. So I will give the reference if you are interested. I believe this author will come and give a colloquium or talk in the first week of November. So very interesting that in an altogether different problem where you recognize patterns and you teach machines how to recognize patterns by using so-called Boltzmann algorithm, hidden there, these guys discover there's a precise real space RG that we do, that we'll be doing next, which was invented by Kadanoff called variational renormalization group. Okay, this is a side remark. Now let's go to so-called block spin. So the idea is, I know that as the system gets more and more ordered, there are correlated domains. So how do I start doing it from microscopic variables? Because I am having an Ising model with microscopic variables. So how do I start from that length scale, namely lattice parameter and microscopic variable, and go to scale, which is the size of the system? So this is where Kadanoff's insight. Kadanoff said that, okay, imagine this is before the real space RG and Wilson's methods got developed. Kadanoff pointed out the following. That is, let me take the problem that I have at hand, namely Ising model, and then also recognize that spins are getting correlated. So they're trying to behave in a collective way. So what can I do to put that information and then extract physics of phase transition? So he said the best thing is take the microscopic spin system and conveniently separate them into blocks. For example, this is one convenient separation. Okay. Now, if I am really in an ordered state, close to an ordered state, most of the time these 9 spins will point up or point down. Suppose I'm starting from a paramagnetic state. Sometimes maybe two spins may be down. So what I'm going to do is, I'm going to define a new variable, which is going to tell me what the majority spin is doing. So let me define an operation. We'll call it set P. I'm going to define a new spin in terms of set of old spin belong to this box. So this S stands for the 9 spins. This could be, for example, a Kronecker delta function, which says that this spin, what I say is the following, that is, right. So if the sum of the spins, so since there are odd number of spins, they will all add up to the maximum value that, so they will all add up to plus 9 or minus 9. The least value they can have is minus 1 and plus 1. So I look at the majority, how the majority of the spins behave, and then define this variable. And this has a very interesting thing that if majority of the spins are positive, it will be plus sign. If the majority of spins is negative, it's minus sign. So I have a new variable which can take plus or minus one variable. So this is the definition of my operator. Now this operator has a very nice property that if I trace over this sigma b by construction, it's equal to 1. It's obvious. Now sometimes it may be convenient for me. So what I'm doing is I'm going to define this renormalization operation. That is, I'm going to define a way of getting collective variable of small boxes, small cluster of spins. So this looks elegant, but in practice, to deal with delta functions may be complicated. So I can imagine another situation in which what I do is I have okay, let me. I can have this, so what it does, instead of saying it is a delta function, it says that I have this way, spins from which I extract a new spin in this way. Now, by definition, if I sum over this sigma, I will get cosh, and that it will cancel with this. So, and also I should divide it by some modulus of. So this is it's obvious thing, and you can make it slightly more general without changing the, because why am I doing it? Because it's important. I do this, basically I'm inserting, that is what I need to do is trace of e to the power minus b j h. J is j by k bt. So this is a convention I will use. So this is equal to product over then I have trace over sigma variable and trace over. So I'm just rewriting. It's like inserting a delta function. If I integrate over sigma, I will get 1. So I go back to the old partition function. So I don't do anything to the partition function's final value. I introduce it. Now I interchange the sigma. And so what I have is trace over sigma and then trace over spin of this quantity P and e to the power minus, so which contains sigma and S. So you will agree that when I do this integration sigma, I will get some integration over S now. Integration over S, I will get something which is a function of sigma. It's just a shift of variables. Why am I doing this? Because I am looking for patterns of the Hamiltonian that is generated by this procedure. Because I started with the Hamiltonian, which had only one parameter, namely coupling between neighbors. I'm ignoring magnetic field. Now I am doing a trick, anticipating some collective behavior of this cluster of spins close to TC, a trick in which I define a new variable by looking at clusters everywhere. And then my intuition tells me that my new Hamiltonian, in terms of this cluster spins, should look similar. The magnitude will be changed, but the form should look similar, which is not true, because what you find is, we will see it explicitly when you do the 2D Ising model. When you generate, you start with nearest neighbor coupling, and then you get the next step of iteration, a modified J, which depends on what you started with. Let me call it a zero. And then in addition, it generates second neighbor coupling constant, which also depends on J, and coupling between four spins, which is also J. Now, in other words, when you do this transformation, this is called majority rule transformation. When you do this transformation and do this integration, it's like what I did in the case of 1D Ising model. I briefly pointed out that I had e to the power of minus beta j, let's say 1, 2, 3, s1, s2, plus s2, s3, 3, s4. If I integrate over s2, then it generates a new coupling between 1 and 3. That's it, nothing more. Whereas if I do it, for example, if you take a cluster like this, and then if I integrate over this, to begin with, I had coupling constant, which is j, j, j. Now at the end, what you find is it generates a new coupling between this spin, and then also a new coupling between this spin, and also a new coupling like this. So for example, this will correspond, if I call it the central spin as 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, I have a new coupling which gets modified. So let's say this is the J at step 1. So this term will correspond to a new term, which is J, let me call it the nearest, next nearest neighbor like this, and then S1 and S2, which was absent because the original Hamiltonian contained only nearest neighbor. This is next nearest neighbor, since I have to go to two steps in the lattice to reach him. So this has been generated. Similarly, I have to take two steps to generate this. Let me say this is 1, 3, S1, S3. Then this will be a one coupling in which I have S1, S2, S3, S4. All these will be generated when I integrate over this. That's obvious if you, because this is something we have done before. That is, what I'm doing is in this decimation. Incidentally, this is called decimation. That is, integrate over some variable, which amounts to doing the majority rule, but with a slightly different form of delta. So when I integrate over this, the partition function, I have minus j, the central spin coupled to all the neighbors, 1 plus 2 plus 3. 1, 2, 3, 4. So this will give me, when I take the trace over, now I can expand this cache. So I will get term containing S1, S2, S1, S3, and also term containing 4 S's. And of course, I will have terms like to the power of n and so on, but they will all collapse to one of the few I pointed out there, one of the 4. Because S has a property, S square is 1. So you say that in this blocking procedure, you generate more and more couplings. Now, I'm going to do a formal analysis. I don't worry about this generated couplings. I'm going to look at consequences of this. So what I will do is, I will say that, OK, let me say I started with many parameters, j, j1, j2, j4, and a whole lot of parameters. And then I continue this procedure. So in general, what will happen? Because I started with the most general Hamiltonian containing 2-spin interaction, 4-spin interactions, and so on, consistent with the symmetry, I can formally say this will become, after step 1, some new numbers, step 1, another new number, and so on. So I start with a large set and go to the next set. Previously, what I did was I started with a very simple set in which all these were absent. I generated this. Now I say that formally I will start with all set and then do this. Then I go from one step and then I keep doing this. Now, the procedure of real space renormalization group, when you do practical computation, amounts to cleverly confining yourself to few of these coupling parameters, because that's only you can handle. So that is where physics comes in. There are so-called Migdal-Cadenoff bond moving approximation, and a variety of names are there. But you don't need to do that approximation to do a formal analysis, because this is a very nice thing. So it is as if you have a vector. You have a point in some n-dimensional. Let's say that this is an m-dimensional space. So you start with some point in n-dimensional space. And every procedure of this decimation, because what I do, this is something I should have mentioned. Since I started with general coupling constant, I get a Hamiltonian, which is like the old Hamiltonian, except that the values of the coupling constants have changed. So correspondingly, the analytic form of the free energy will remain the same. In other words, if I started with my free energy with some set of coupling constant J, I will get the same analytic form with the coupling replaced by J prime, and just a scaling factor, which is I put the correct okay. It simply follows from the definition. That is, what am I doing? I start with a set of coupling constant, and there is a corresponding Hamiltonian. Then I do this operation, integrate over spins, and introduce a set of new variables, which is at a new scale. That is, a lattice parameter has been expanded from A to B times A. For example, in this case, the new lattice parameter is this. From A, it has gone to 4A. So the scaling factor is 4. Then otherwise, just by construction, the Hamiltonian remains form invariant. In the example I said, if I started with nearest neighbor interaction, the Hamiltonian changes its form because it produces new couplings. So here I say that, OK, let me start with arbitrary coupling to begin with. So I'm going to remain only within this vector, this space of M. Except that it will move to a different point. So the free energy I evaluate will have the same analytic form, except that the old couplings will be replaced by new couplings. For example, if we take this J1, it will be a function of J, J1, J2, and so on. Similarly, if we take this J2, it will be a function of the old couplings. So I have formally put it as J prime. Okay? This is simple formal definition. Now it is this which we are going to analyze formally. I have not done any decimation operation. I just started with some general Hamiltonian specified by some m parameters. And then I do renormalization operation. Then I get modified parameters. Since the form of the Hamiltonian remains the same, the free energy that I evaluate better be the same. Then in the process, I generate some constant p's, which I keep separate like this. Okay. Now I'm going to analyze this for critical behavior. So this approach tells me the following. That is, suppose I am starting with, let's say, Ising model in two dimension at the TC as given by Ansager. Then what will happen? As I renormalize, I will remain critical, and then I will get an effective Hamiltonian, which I do not know what it is, but it will be called a fixed point Hamiltonian. So what it tells me is the following picture. Suppose I take some three coupling constants, K1. So there is a notion of critical surface. I will explain what, as I said, I solve 2D Ising model. I know there the j has a specific value, some log of 1 plus square root of 2, dimensionless unit, as solved by Ansager. Now I do renormalization. I will get more terms. It will be generated. But I keep doing it. This general analysis of this recursion relation tells me that as I keep moving, as I keep this recurrence, I may wander up to infinity, or I may reach a point called a fixed point. For example, in a simple case of one-dimensional Ising model, you please recall. Yeah, it's good to discuss that example. Please recall that I said that if you take spins like this, and then integrate over this alternate spins, you get new coupling constant, which I call as J1, is equal to that is tan hyperbolic gets squared, and that becomes effectively this. Now, if you keep doing this, you will find a situation in which tan hyperbolic J, I will call it a star equal to. That is, both left and right hand side becomes the same. That is, I iterate, there is no change. That's called a fixed point. It turns out this fixed point is trivial. It has two solutions, J star equal to 0 and J star equal to 1, which corresponds to 0 temperature or infinite temperature. Let us see the flow of the parameter and renormalization, because it's a very simple example. We can see it explicitly. So let me plot this curve, tan hyperbolic j. So it has this form, well-known form. So this is tan hyperbolic j. Now I plot the right-hand side, which is square of that. You can see that the function is very similar. And except that it will be, since tan hyperbolic is always less than 1, it will be below this. And then here it will have quadratic behavior and so on, which will also asymptotically reach this value. Now, what does this iteration mean? It means, give me a value of j, this, let's say this initial point. Then the tan hyperbolic square is here. What I do is, I look at the corresponding value J1 simply by looking at this point. That is, this corresponds to square of this given J value. And if I want to find out an argument J1 which will give me the same value, I have to simply draw a horizontal axis. Then the next thing is I look at this. That's what happens. So this recursion will take me from here to this point, to this point, and very quickly I will reach the origin, which is a fixed point. So if you plot this in terms of this behavior of k or j, which is j over kt, essentially what you find is, or if you look at it in temperature axis, converting this, you find there is a fixed point at t equals 0, which is an unstable fixed point. That you start from anywhere here, you end up, so you flow this way. And where do you flow to? You flow to temperature infinity. So it's very simple. In other words, you start at very low temperature, where spins look ordered over some length scale. So you do this decimation operation. By the time you reach the scale of the correlation length in this decimation operation, the block spins will start behaving independently. So it is effectively, in the scaled version, it's at a high temperature state. So that means the effective temperature, as seen by the blocks, becomes higher and higher, and you reach this. It's a very simple fixed point analysis for one-dimensional problem. Now, what I pointed out is that when you come to this two-dimensional problem, your fixed point is not going to be at infinite temperature or zero temperature. It's going to be at some finite temperature in this parameter space. So, for example, if you take any line here, if it is an unstable fixed point, you will move away from here. Or if you are sitting at the critical surface, everybody will come to this. And then if you are off the surface, suppose somewhere you are below here, then you will come very close to the fixed point and then flow away. These are all the things I will demonstrate it analytically in the next thing. That is just by taking this relation, and then there is a connection between J and J prime. And then formally expanding, assuming existence of a fixed point and expanding around it, you will find the behavior of this trajectory close to this fixed point. And then the way at which it flows are characterized by some eigenvalues of some simple matrix equation. And they will tell you the parameters that we talk about, namely the somewhere it's there, this exponents. So we will quickly get information about these two exponents, which control the flow towards a critical point. So this is what I will do next. So let me, so what have I done today? Today, I just inspired by mean field theory and mean field and experiments, Vidam suggested that if you look at the singular part of the free energy, it should have this homogeneity property, which is called the scaling hypothesis. Basically, it said that all singularities, for example, in the magnetic phase transition, should be governed by just two numbers, the way the temperature scales and the way magnetic field scales. And then by taking this as a formal ansatz for free energy, you can take derivative of the free energy with respect to magnetic field temperature and show that the magnetization exponent is connected to Q and P like this, and the specific heat exponent is connected like this, and so on. And that also brings in these nice equalities, which says that what you observe in experiments, then so-called this six exponents, they are all not independent. They are all connected through these four relations, which is Rushbrook, Vidam, and this can be all obtained by looking at this as well as correlation function and doing a simple derivative and then evaluating it at the critical point. Okay, then having said that, I showed that I went on to discuss this in the language of renormalization group. So how will I get homogeneity hypothesis? How will I get it microscopically? So there, Kadanoff's insight was, I should go from my microscopic variable to new variable in a iterative and successive fashion. So he said, let me consider block of spins. For example, this 9 spin. So it's called Kadanoff's block spin hypothesis. And then try to extract a new variable, collective variable, by this simple majority rule. It says that if majority of the spins are positive, I will put +1 for this new variable. If majority of spins are negative, I will put -1. Or I can have a more friendly definition in terms of this. And then what I do is I basically take this and insert it in the original expression for partition function. I'm not doing anything because the numerical value of my partition function is not changing. But then I change integration between the new variable I have introduced namely the cluster variable and the old variable, and then integrate over the microscopic variable. That gives me a Hamiltonian defined in terms of this new collective variable. Now, when you do it for simple clusters with the simple Hamiltonian to begin with, you find proliferation of coupling constants. You start with nearest neighbor coupling constant. You end up with next nearest neighbor coupling constant and four spin coupling constant and so on. And that was not happening in the case of 1D Ising model. It was very special. Okay, so unperturbed by that, what Kadanoff does is, okay, let's do a formal analysis. Let's assume that I can do this formally starting with any number of coupling constant. Then formally I will get the same number of parameters, but the numerical value will change. So this defines a path in the m-dimensional parameter space. And then in general, whenever I have this nonlinear recursion phenomena, I either wander around or I reach a fixed point. And in the one-dimensional case, it's very clear what the fixed point is. There are cases in which I wander around or go into cycle called limit cycle. There are strange attractors and a variety of phenomena. In fact, there are realization of many of them in spin models also. So with that general assumptions, our analysis of critical behavior amounts to following this trajectory closely and analyzing its behavior close to the critical point. So all that can be done generally without doing actual renormalization operation, which is what I will do next. So I showed it for one dimension. In one dimension, you get a very simple result. That's, you remain within one parameter, and then you start from one point, you converge very quickly to infinite temperature fixed point. And then in fact, I leave it as an exercise. When you add a magnetic field, it becomes a little more complicated, but eventually, again, you can have a parameter space which is just two-dimensional. Because in one dimension, when you do this operation, you start with the J, nearest neighbor, and a magnetic field. And then in the next step, you generate a J1 and a H1. This J1 will be a function of what you started with, and H also will be a function of what you started. You can analytically get this and see the flow of this process in the HT plane. There again, you will find stable fixed point and unstable fixed point. OK, so this is what I wanted to cover today. And tomorrow, that means next Monday, I will do this explicitly for a two-dimensional model. There, you know, you will see that you can't be really sitting in a general large number of parameters, because in practice, it becomes complicated. So you live with nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor and play some trick and do some approximations and get an expression for TC, which is, depending on what you do, can be accurate within 10%. And you get expression for critical exponents, which are again accurate with respect to 10 or 15%. Now, there are new methods which have come in the scene. In fact, there is a very nice review article by Kadanoff. In 2014, in Reviews of Modern Physics, elaborating on some new approach to this problem called a tensor network approach. In fact, key players in this game are here, right at perimeter, Giffre, Vidal, Zhao Gangwen, Zheng Chenghu, who have developed. And also Levin, who is one of the masters. He's right now here attending, talking in a conference. So where they introduce a new approach to this renormalization procedure based on what is called tensor network. And it turns out technically it's very powerful. It can give you many of these things extremely accurately. So in fact, this paper by Kadanoff is an appreciation of this new development, which came from, you know, tensor network states in quantum many-body theory, but it has very remarkable implications in this field. And recently, there are nice papers by Giffre et al. So one is called TGR, another is called TNR. This is tensor network normalization. This is I don't remember expand. So there's a, there are very interesting developments. Some of you may be interested in following. Okay. So tomorrow, originally I thought I will do some of this tensor network, but I don't think I'll have time. Tomorrow I will do two dimension in some detail with factors of pi and half put in place, and show you how to get critical exponents approximately. And then the last class, probably I will do interplay between quantum field theory and quantum on classical statistical mechanics. Finally, both of them turn out to be governed by very general symmetry principles. You integrate, you do some path integration. So there are very deep connections between quantum field theories and statistical mechanics. So probably that will be the last part of my talk. Any questions? Yes.
How can we see from this that we have interaction between like one and two?
Oh yeah, yeah, here. So good. So this is the example I said that I took the Boltzmann factor of five spins and then integrated over the central spin. So it's called a decimation. Then I immediately get cosh. Now what I say is that now you exponentiate it back.
But then you will just get exponential of S1 plus S2, the old
linear. Oh, sorry. Thank you. It will be exponential of. Yeah. So if I write it in this form, it's manifest. So you are right that when I expand it, I will get only. But then I take it back up. Now, if you expand this log cosh, you'll automatically get linear term. So this is the, you know, I have to bring it, this new partition function, a new Boltzmann factor, into the old form. So I exponentiate it. And this, when I expand it, I will get S1, S2, S2, S3, and S1 with appropriate coefficients. It will now log. At the moment, in this procedure, it only generates up to 4 spin. Up to 4 spin. Yeah, because it truncates. You know, because any other higher powers come, will come back to itself. So now, if I am bold enough and go the next step, I will generate 8 spin interaction. Then, if I do more, I will get 16 and so on. So it will explode. But the numerical values may be different. So that is what is done in this general analysis. The general analysis, you say, you don't care. Where is that? Yeah, you say that you start with some set of parameters, which are many. It could be 8-spin interaction, 16-spin interaction. I name them as J16. And then I know general property of flow of these vectors under iteration, because this relation between J1 and J, that's iteration. In general, it's a nonlinear equation, the same way we had. This is a nonlinear equation. So if I write J1, it will be in another language. So it will be tan hyperbolic inverse of the initial value. So it's a very nonlinear function. Give me a J1. So then I have to do two operations. Take tan hyperbolic square and tan hyperbolic inverse and get this. So that this iteration, when you have a coupled number of parameters, takes you, in general, some path. So then there are general statements that you can reach a fixed point. That is what we assume. And then we'll do an analysis around that fixed point and get the exponents that appears in the homogeneity hypothesis or Vadim's scaling law.